Job chapter 10. Hope you're there with us. And so again, just as we've been going through this book of Job, we're in the midst of seeing this dialogue going on between Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And we're in a bit of a repetition that we see where one of the friends will speak out and speak into Job's life, and Job will respond, and another friend will speak out, Job will respond, and so we've seen the first two friends speak. Well, tonight we're going to get into the third friend, Zophar. And much of their conversation is much the same. They're basically telling Job, you've got to just repent of your sin. Obviously, there's sin at work in your life, and that's why you're going through this suffering. But again, remember now, the story of Job is that they don't see what's going on the other side of their own dimension, in a sense. They're not seeing what's going on in the heavenlies. So often we don't know what is going on in the heavenlies, why God is doing what he's doing, why God is allowing to happen what he's allowing to happen. And Job and his friends don't have that luxury. They don't get to see what's going on because Satan, remember, came to God. And God told Satan, hey, have you considered my servant Job? He's a blameless and upright man. And Satan's thinking, he's only worshiping you and following you because you've blessed him so abundantly. Take away all those things and Job is going to curse you. And this is a dialogue going on between Satan and God. So what does God do? In his sovereignty, he says, Satan, go ahead, have at it. Just don't, harm him. And so Satan goes after him, and he goes after his servants, goes after his livestock, his riches. He takes away his children, his family. And still, Job's like, I'm not going to curse God. And Satan's like, well, he's still got his health. Take away his health, and then he's going to really, lay into you, God. Then we'll really see what this guy's made of. And God says, okay, you can harm him and take away his health, but do not take away his life. And so now he's got these boils, and he's in great pain and discomfort. He's got this mourning and grief going on, as well as now physical pain. And yet, all through this, Job isn't cursing God. And God's allowing this to happen. Oftentimes, he allows misery to happen in life so that ministry can flow out of it. And that's exactly what God is allowing with Job in his sovereignty. Job doesn't know it, but yet God's doing a work. Just like we saw a few weeks ago, the man that was blind in the book of John, and his disciples are wondering, who sinned, his parents or him, that he was born blind? And Jesus is going, listen, nobody sinned. It's not about sin. It's that the work of God may be done, so that Jesus may be glorified in this man's life. And so often, the Lord's at work, even in our misery, so that his ministry can flow out of that. That's what we see happening in the story of Job here. But once again, as we get into chapter 10, we see Job speaking out to God, and he's responding to his friends, and he's conversing with God, and he's just pouring out his heart to him. It's not an easy road. Job is not sitting here just taking it all in gladly, going, well, Lord, this is really exciting to see what you're doing and what you're going to have to do. Job is hurting. He's kind of a wreck. This is not pleasant by any means for Job. But he's taking it to the Lord. And so let's read what we see in verse 1, chapter 10. He says, my soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh, or do you see as man sees? Are your days like the days of a mortal man? Are your years like the days of a mighty man, that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin? Although you know that I'm not wicked, and there's no one who can deliver from your hand. So Job's just pouring out his heart. He's expressing this inner anguish he's going through. He's kind of like getting a little bit contentious here. He's like, I'm gonna go now and just with freedom just pour out my complaint and the bitterness of my soul. I'm gonna take it to the Lord now. He's just kind of laying. He's kind of getting a little bit, upset here in a sense, and he's wanting to find out answers. But notice this as we go through the book of Job. Never does Job really directly and clearly, specifically, ask God to simply heal him. This isn't really what Job's about here. God's saying, Lord, just heal me already. What more so Job is after, and really the more important question that I think many of us has is, why? Why, God, is this happening? Why are you allowing this to happen? What is going on here? Those are the more immediate questions that people have in the world. Why? So Job asked God to show him why he is contending with him. Job knows that this isn't a response to unrighteousness or wicked living by any means, because Job's been an upright and blameless man, and he knows it. But that's what makes this all the more frustrating to Job. What is this about then? I could understand if I've gone and done something really bad. If I've gone and committed adultery or murdered somebody. I get it then, Lord. You can lay this on me and I get it. I understand. But I've not done anything that I see has been overly immoral. Why is this happening? And so he's pouring out his heart to the Lord here. He's experiencing this contention of God upon him. Now Spurgeon, Charles Spurgeon, suggests several answers for why God may contend with you. It may be that God is contending with you to show you his power to uphold you. It may be that God is contending with you to go and develop your graces. It may be that God is contending with you because you have some secret sin that is doing you great damage and God is dealing with that. That may be the case. But it may be that God is contending with you because he wants you to enter into the fellowship of his sufferings. Fellowship becomes a much more intimate thing when we go through that with one another. I believe God called Abraham into that fellowship of sufferings when he says, take now your son, your only son, and place him on an altar, sacrifice him. Fellowship of suffering with God. It may be also that God is contending with you to simply humble you. And we know that God is carrying out his good and perfect will and purpose in all of these things. And we need to come in a place of faith and trust and say, God, I may not understand all these things, but I need to respond by faith and trust and seek what you want me to get out of this. Now, Job questions if it seems right that God would treat the very work of his hands like this there in verse 3. Or make it appear as though he's agreeing with the counsel of the wicked there. Job knows that God is beyond human limitations, yet Job ponders the fact that it seems as though God is responding like a man and seeing sin as a result of his suffering. So Job confesses that he's not wicked and that God is aware of that. And Job hasn't been hiding anything from God. Now, this isn't Job being cocky here. These are just the facts. I have nothing to hide here. I've done nothing really to deserve this. And God even backed him up on that in Job chapter 1, verse 8. When God's speaking to Satan, he says, there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. That's what God said of Job. So Job's not being cocky here or having a high estimation of himself. He's going, this is just who I am. And God himself has backed him up on that. But Job next goes on to wonder why God has even made him then to begin with, if this is what life was going to be for Job. So look at verse 8. Your hands have made me and fashioned me an intricate unity, yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay, and will you turn me into dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You have granted me life and favor, and your care has preserved my spirit. So Job understands clearly that God is the one who made him. Now, this is remarkable because remember, Job here predates the law. He predates any kind of written revelation of any scripture. Many believe that Job was perhaps a contemporary of Abraham or existed around that time, maybe before or just after Abraham. But this is before any of the word has been written, where they've been able to read any of the writings of Moses and see the Genesis account and how this all came to be. This is all before that. Yet Job knows fully well that he is a creator and that he himself was created from dust and that God has formed him and he's made an intricate unity. Isn't that great? I mean, just that Job at this time, before even having the word, that they understand that fearfully and wonderfully I've been made, just like the psalmist would say. Wonderfully I've been made, an intricate unity here. It's amazing to think of our bodies. I mean, I don't know how scientists, how people in a right mind continue to reason that we've just kind of come about from just random chance. From the goo to the zoo to you. I mean, that's kind of what people think, right? This is the process. And yet we're intricately made. How can anybody deny that there has to be a designer behind that? It boggles my mind. But it's like the wiser people become in their own mind, the more foolish they are, it seems sometimes. And Job even now understands this intricately made, that you have formed me from the dust. You've like curled me like cheese. It's like the idea is that you just kind of, you know, put me together and you formed me. You put this skin and flesh and put my bones and sinews together. You're the one that's done all this, Lord. And that you've granted me life and favor. And your care has preserved my spirit. But Job's concern is, if God had taken such care to create him, to knit Job together, why would he go through all that just to destroy him then? Why would God go through all that just if he's going to end up, you know, causing Job to suffer and die? It all just didn't make sense to Job. Of course, things aren't always going to make sense to us. This is where faith is important. What we do know is that God has given us life. He's the author of it. And ultimately, our lives are in his hands. He's given us favor. He's shown us grace when we didn't deserve it. And he's shown care by preserving us. That's enough to say, Lord, I'm going to keep my faith in you. Whether or not life makes sense, whether I understand why I'm going through this particular thing, I have to understand and come to that reality all the time that you have granted me life and favor. I don't deserve anything. The very fact that I'm living and breathing is your favor in my life. And your care has preserved my spirit. Job didn't always see how God was preserving him, but he most certainly was. And he acknowledges that here. Now, when things don't make sense or you question God, just reflect on those truths. Reflect on the realities of God's love and his favor and his care upon your life. For he cares for you deeply. Verse 13 goes on to say, "And these things you have hidden in your heart. I know that this was with you. If I sin, then you mark me, and you will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I'm wicked, woe to me. Even if I'm righteous, I cannot lift up my head. I'm full of disgrace. See my misery? If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion. And again, you show yourself awesome against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your indignation toward me. Changes in war are ever with me." Job accuses God of charging up all of his sin so that he could just have a heyday in punishing him. That's kind of how Job is seeing things right now. And then he imagines how awful things would have been if he was actually a full-on wicked guy. It was bad enough as a righteous person, the stuff that he's having to endure. Job's thinking, man, let alone if I was a wicked, immoral person, how bad that would be. It says in verse 18, "Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Oh, that I had perished and no eye had seen me. I would have been as though I had not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Cease. Leave me alone that I may take a little comfort before I go to the place from which I shall not return, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, a land as darkness itself is the shadow of death without any order, where even the light is like darkness." Now, just like in chapter 3, Job feels that non-existence would have been better than having to go through life in the state that he's going through it right now. He just feels like, Lord, it would have been better for me not to be born at all. He's not contemplating suicide. He's not looking to end his life. But he's saying, I just feel, man, it would have been better if I just was not even born at all. What's the use of being brought out of the womb if I'm just going to get beat up like this? So Job concludes this speech now in this chapter by begging for a little bit of respite in his pain and before he has to, you know, depart to the land of deep darkness. And that's the mysterious afterlife that to people in Job's day, they had little kind of understanding. They had a concept, but not a full picture of what that looked like. Here Job reveals the Old Testament concept of Sheol. It was a land of darkness. It was something without order, kind of like the kind of order which one observed in the physical creation here. Now, this represented the highest thinking in that age about the future. There were gleams now and again of something more, but they were fitful and uncertain, soon overtaken by dark and sad forebodings. The patriarch called the present life day and the future night. We know, however, that in comparison, the present is like night, and the future is like day. It's going to get brighter and brighter in Jesus Christ, isn't it? And so their concept, their understanding of what the afterlife held for them was limited. They didn't understand fully. And so Job is just crying out, I wish that I wouldn't even been brought out of the womb, that I could just move on. Just, he's basically saying, Lord, just leave me alone. Let me just retire to the place of the dead, the shadow of death here, land of darkness, where I can just kind of rest without having to deal with any of these things. Now, in chapter 11 here, now we get into the third friend's sort of message and an instruction to Job. He gives his two bits, Zophar here, he gives his two bits about the condition of Job and the reason why he is going through this. Now, he makes three accusations against Job. First of all, that Job is guilty of sin, that Job is ignorant of God, and that Job is stubborn in his refusal to repent. This is Zophar's accusations. Now, what's interesting is we read through this chapter, there's going to be many things that we read that sound right. Theologically, you can look at that and go, yeah, that's true. It's a general truth, but it's misapplied in the way that not only Zophar, but the other friends, Eliphaz and Bildad, have been applying these truths to Job. Because this wasn't the case for Job. They're looking at things. Remember, these three are kind of like the original health and wealth prosperity preachers here. They're the ones going, man, you live right, God's going to bless you. If God's not blessing you, well, it's because you're not living right. And so they're thinking, Job, you're going through a real trial. So the summation of that is that you're not living right. You got to deal with your sin. Get right with God and you'll be blessed again. Now, there's some truth to that we've got to confess sin, that we're not promised an easy road if we're living in sin. But these were not truths that were to be applied to Job because this went beyond their sphere of thinking regarding their theology. Their theology was limited. And so we'll see this kind of break down for us. And it, their friends all had a very similar message and instruction to Job, but they were off because it didn't apply into Job's condition or situation. Look at verse 1 here of chapter 11. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered and said, should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be vindicated? Should your empty talk make men hold their peace? And when you mock, should no one rebuke you? For you have said, my doctrine is pure, and I'm clean in your eyes. So Zophar is a little less diplomatic than the other friends were. Zophar comes at Job with little compassion and understanding. He just basically comes at Job, and he's basically calling him a blowhard. He's just like saying, Job, stop talking already. Can anything good come out of the multitude of words here? You're just full of boasting and empty talk. This is sort of how Zophar is responding to Job. Just like, zip it already, Job. I mean, real compassion, isn't it, when you got a guy who's scraping the boils in the you know, dump yard. He's in pain. He's lost everything around him. And here he comes now, you know. Oh, just zip it already, Job. Just deal with this. You got to get right. I mean, little compassion. Now, Zophar says that Job's doctrine has been pure and that he's been clean. It's kind of like he's saying, Job, you think you're so perfect. You think you're just sinless. You think you're just so awesome. But this isn't what Job has been claiming. Zophar isn't properly representing things here because Job has only claimed that he hasn't done anything for which God needs to correct or punish him. Job's never claimed to be sinless or pure, perfect in that regard. Again, remember, it's God that has called Job blameless and upright. Job's not claiming anything beyond what he should, but Zophar is not grasping this, and he's needlessly condemning Job now. Not the kind of friend you want by you in this sort of time of need. Verse 5, Zophar goes on, but oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for they would double your prudence. Know, therefore, that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. Can you search out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than heaven. What can you do deeper than Sheol? What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes by, imprisons and gathers to judgment, then who can hinder him? For he knows deceitful men. He sees wickedness also. Will he not then consider it? For an empty-headed man will be wise when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. Interesting, isn't it? We'll get to that in a second. But Zophar wants God, look at that in verse 5. Zophar is basically wanting God to confirm and speak everything that they have been saying so far. Oh, that God would speak now, he's saying to him, and open his lips against you. But Zophar doesn't know what he's asking. Because when we're wanting God to pronounce judgment on someone, we have to be ready to receive the same. Right? Perhaps we're the ones that are needing to hear a rebuke from the Lord or a word of correction more than the one we're seeking to be judged. Whenever we're pointing the finger, you know the saying, when we're pointing the finger at someone, we got three more pointing back at us and a thumb, whatever that represents, is doing something there too. But pointing the finger, you got several more pointing right back at you. And so often we're saying, Lord, would you just speak to that person and just convict them and show them where they're wrong? And sometimes, man, if you're going to pray that, you need to be ready for the Lord to speak in your heart and say, hey, let me reveal what you could be doing differently or how maybe you've responded unfavorably here. That was Zophar here. He's saying, God, speak. But Zophar, be careful what you ask for. Because they're going to get theirs from the Lord later on in the book of Job. I mean, God's going to come down and say, you three had it all wrong. You misrepresented me. You need to be the ones that are getting your lives right with me. And that's going to happen there at the end of Job. Now, a lot of what Zophar and Eliphaz and Bildad, the other two friends for that matter, a lot of what they said was true. Again, these were general truths that they were throwing out, but they were misapplied. He says here, God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. Now, we can say that's true. And we're thankful for that. Right? Our iniquity, our sin, deserved death. We deserved hell, didn't we? But God, in his grace and mercy, did not give that to us. In fact, he allowed his son, Jesus, to die for us, to be condemned, to take the judgment that we deserved from God. And he allowed Jesus to do that so that we could be spared and given life. So yeah, we could say that God exacts from us less than our iniquity deserves. He's shown us grace and mercy. We're thankful for that. But what Zophar is saying, Job, be thankful that God only robbed you or stole or took from you your 10 children and your livestock, your riches, your wealth, and your health. Be thankful that that's all that God took, because he should have taken a lot more. This is kind of what Zophar is saying to him. But Zophar's implication here is that, again, that God could have been much worse to Job. This is what Zophar's implication is to Job. God could have been much harsher towards you. You, Job, actually deserved much worse. Lord, spare me from friends like this, right? I mean, this is rough stuff that Job's getting. And Zophar is misapplying a truth of God here to Job, because this did not speak to Job's situation at all. Again, Zophar pronounces the truth about God in that God is limitless. He's beyond finding out. And we know that to be true. But the implication to Job from Zophar is that he should just be quiet and stop trying to hide his sin. Because God will pass by and gather all these things to judgment anyway. So Job might as well just fess up. And then Zophar gets especially mean and sarcastic here in verse 12, saying that an empty-headed man, meaning a stupid man in verse 12, will become wise when we see a wild donkey give birth to a human. Or how some translators say, give birth to a tame colt. It just wouldn't be, you know, natural for a wild donkey to give birth to a tame colt, to a human for that matter. And so what Zophar is saying is Job, you're just acting like a stupid man. You're not going to get any wisdom here before a wild donkey gives birth to a human. He's slamming Job here, saying, stop trying to be so wise and innocent. You're far from it. This is what Zophar is laying out to Job. Very harsh. Very strong. And he goes on in verse 13. Say, if you would prepare your heart and stretch out your hands toward him, if iniquity were in your hand and you put it far away and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents, then surely you could lift up your face without spot. Yes, you could be steadfast and not fear. because you would forget your misery and remember it as waters that have passed away, and your life would be brighter than noonday. Though you were dark, you would be like the morning, and you would be secure because there's hope. Yes, you would dig around you and take your rest in safety. You would also lie down, and no one would make you afraid. Yes, many would court your favor, but the eyes of the wicked will fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope, loss of life. So far, final counsel to Job is to just repent. Saying all this, Job, is just a result of your sin. So get right with God, and then you will begin to enjoy, once again, favor from the Lord. You'll prosper. You'll be blessed. This is all going to come back on you again. God will bless and prosper you for living righteously, but he's going to punish you for living wickedly. This was their theology. This is what they're thinking. But again, none of that was true for Job. This is the sovereignty of God at work here. So Zophar is saying that all the wicked have to look forward to is loss of life. Again, it's a general truth, but it doesn't have to be applied correctly to Job's. It doesn't have to be applied that way to Job's situation or circumstance. And this is for us here a reminder, isn't it, how we need to be slow to judge and make assumptions as to why people are going through what they're going through, whether a person is suffering or whether a person is even prospering. We need to be careful to make assumptions as to go, oh, well, that's why that's happening. Oh, well, they're really prospering because they went on a mission trip, so I guess I better get on the next mission trip so that I can prosper. Or they're really suffering because, well, I think they're just a gossip. And so that's God just coming down. We have to be careful that we don't make assumptions as to why people are going through what they're going through and cast judgments. Some of those things might be true. But we just can't cast that out as a overall universal truth for every person, because God is sovereign. And God's going to show mercy who he shows mercy to. He's the author of life, and he can do with it what he wants. And ultimately, he's going to move in ways where he's going to be glorified and seen. And if we can live a life in a way through our discomfort, through suffering, through misery, where people can look at that and see our faith and go, I need to have that. There's hope in that person when no one else I see would have hope in that situation. What gives? It's an opportunity to talk about Jesus, to show Jesus. It's an opportunity for people to give their life to Jesus, knowing that they don't have that and they need that. So God is able to work through all of these things that are going on in our lives. So we just can't cast out a blanket statement and go, well, they're suffering because of that, or they're prospering because of that. And Job reminds us of that lesson here for us. This is exactly what Zophar and Bildad and Eliphaz were doing with Job, but they were wrong. A lot of things they said had truth to it, but it was misapplied truth. Let's look at chapter 12 here. Job now begins to respond to Zophar. So Job answered, chapter 12, verse 1, and he said, no doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you, but I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Indeed, who does not know such things as these? So Job, he can see he's getting a little bothered now by these guys, right? And now he starts to take some pages out of their book, and he gets a little bit sarcastic with them, basically saying to them, oh, you're like the only people that really know anything, right? It's all on you guys. In fact, wisdom will die out once you go to the grave. Wisdom will cease to exist once you go, because it all rests in you. I'm so thankful to have you in my life, you three. You're so wonderful. Job simply tells them that he too knows these things. In fact, these are general truths that are familiar to most people. This is what Job is saying to them. And he says, I am one mocked by his friends, in verse 4, who called on God and he answered him, the just and blameless who is ridiculed. A lamp is despised in the thought of one who is at ease. It is made ready for those whose feet slip. The tents of robbers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure in what God provides by his hand. It's been wisely said that when life is good, we don't have many questions, but when life is bad, we don't have many answers. So to his friends, Job says, you guys are at ease, but you're comfortable. But I've got some questions for you that perhaps you haven't thought through. So Job brings up the fact that God is leading all things according to his sovereignty, not according to what seems right to us. Because Job says, even robbers and provokers of God seem at times to be living in comfort. How do you explain that then, Zophar, Bildad, and Eliphaz, with your theological belief? How do you explain that those that are robbers, thieves, and they're reviling against God, and they're living in comfort, they're prospering times, how do you explain that away with your theological disposition? What about what we see in nature? Job brings up the animal kingdom to challenge the thinking next. Look at verse 7. But now ask the beasts, and they will teach you, and the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you, and the fish of the sea will explain to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Does not the ear test words, and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men, and with length of days, understanding. So Job is saying, all of nature will reveal to you the power of God, that life is in the hand of the Creator. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and there are times when the bear is going to come and attack and devour the wolf. Is that unjust? No, it's just the way it is. It's the hand of the Lord. This is what Job is saying here. Can you look at that and go, oh, that's just so wrong. There's an imbalance. That's just the Lord, the Creator of all. That's just the hand of the Lord. And then he says, the ear tests what you hear, and the mouth tastes your food. Job is telling his critics by this that they should be seeing that what they're saying is not lining up with the evidence that's around them. Wisdom, however, will come with age and experience. He ends there in verse 12. Kind of one last dig at his friends. He's kind of like saying, listen, you guys aren't quite wise as you think you are. That may come as you grow a little more. There need to be some maturing for them. Verse 13, with him are wisdom and strength. He has counsel and understanding. If he breaks a thing down, it cannot be rebuilt. If he imprisons a man, there can be no release. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the earth. With him are strength and prudence. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away, plundered, and makes fools of the judges. He loosens the bonds of kings and binds their waist with a belt. He leads princes away, plundered, and overthrows the mighty. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes and disarms the mighty. He uncovers deep things out of darkness and brings the shadow of death to light. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and guides them. He takes away the understanding of the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a pathless wilderness. Verse 25, they grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. So here we have just a wonderful and great statement of the sovereignty and power of God. It seems as well a rebuke to the previous statement of Zophar, where he accused Job of not knowing God. Well, Job makes it pretty clear that he's quite aware of the greatness of God here. And he sees the hand of the Lord at work in all situations around him. Notice here, we see that Job showed God's power over material things. That he breaks the thing down and it cannot be rebuilt. He showed God's power over men if he imprisons a man. He showed God's power over nature if he withholds the water. He showed God's power over the deceit. The deceiver are even his. He showed God's power over the wise. He leads counselors away plundered and makes fools of the judges, verse 17. He showed God's power over the rulers. He loosens the bonds of kings. He leads princes away plundered. He showed God's power over the eloquent because he deprived the trusted ones of speech, verse 20. And he showed God's power over the nations. I love that. He makes nations great and destroys them, verse 23. Making America great is not up to a man. It's up to the Lord, right? God's the one that makes nations great. And if he so chooses, he'll bring a nation down. Because God is sovereign. God's in control of all things. So Job is stating here, in light of what he's been challenged with, I know exactly who God is, and I'm fully aware of his great power and might and his sovereignty. In short, history shows that all the world's leading authorities have not enjoyed God's blessing as they should have if his friend's major premise was correct. That none of these people should be enjoying any of these things if you stand by what you are preaching there. So Job is challenging his friends and their view of things. God simply does what he wants regardless of the action of men. God is not having to act according to the actions of men. Oh, I guess I got to do this now because you've done that. God's not the responder to men. God's the initiator of all things. And God isn't going to be dictated by what men are doing and having to respond favorably. Go, oh, well, you've done that. Now I got to do this. God is sovereign. Now, yes, his word teaches that he will bless those that are walking in obedience. We understand that. But that blessing oftentimes might look different than what we think of as blessing. He's already blessed us in giving us life and forgiveness of sin and eternal hope. That's really all the blessing that we need. But God does what he wants regardless of the action of men. Chapter 13, Job continues on. Behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. But you forgers of lies, you are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be silent, and it would be your wisdom. And Job knew that he wasn't getting anything from his friends that he didn't already know. He wasn't inferior to them. They didn't hold a superior level of knowledge over Job. Job would rather just go to the Lord directly and speak to him. And notice here, it says, oh, that you would just be silent, verse 5, and it would be your wisdom. Should always be the response to us immediately, isn't it? You know, just to respond in silence and just see what the Lord wants us to know and understand in those situations. Sometimes the best wisdom is just silence, just being a support and comfort to those in need. And our first action, our first course of action for us when we're going through difficulty is just to go to God. Job is saying there, I would speak to the Almighty in verse 3, and I desire to reason with God. You know, there's nothing wrong with getting counsel from our friends, but may we hear from the Lord and take up our concerns with him. May we not be so quick to rely upon counsel of friends, because we can see here that their counsel may not always be correct. Our first course of action should always be to go to the Lord and take up our concerns with him and ask the Lord, what do you need me to know from this? What are you wanting to teach me this? What do you want me to get out of this, Lord? What would you reveal to me? Oh, the Lord can certainly speak through friends and bring confirmation to what God's already revealing to us, but that first course of action should always be to the Lord. And so Job is saying, I'm going to take this up with the Lord. And so he says in verse 6, now hear my reasoning and heed the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak wickedly for God and talk deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for God? Will it be well when he searches you out? Or can you mock him as one mocks a man? He will surely rebuke you if you secretly show partiality. Will not his excellence make you afraid and the dread of him fall upon you? Your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. So the friends of Job wouldn't have a leg to stand on if they came under the scrutiny of God. They've been deceitful. They've been lying fools, Job says, in how they represented God. And like I said, the tables will eventually be turned on these friends at the end of Job, in Job chapter 42, when God is going to reprove these men for misrepresenting him. God's going to call them out on the table here, on the carpet, I should say. Going to turn the table and then call them out on the carpet. The table might be carpeted, I don't know, but that's what he's going to do. And so they're going to have to answer to God one day. Here they're trying to tell Job where they're going wrong, and they need to ask themselves where they might be off. And the truths that they've been holding on to are, Job says, nothing more than ashes, verse 12. They may sound good, but they're as crumbly as clay. There's really nothing substantial to what they're saying. He says in verse 13, hold your peace with me and let me speak. Then let come on me what may. Why do I take my flesh and my teeth and put my life in my hands? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. He also shall be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. Listen carefully to my speech and to my declaration with your ears. See now, I prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish. So Job didn't want these guys butting in. Doesn't want them to keep yapping. He kind of just tells them right now, listen guys, let me finish. Hold your peace and let me speak. Just let me continue on here before you jump in. And Job gets to the very core of what is keeping him going through these tough times. What does he say there? in verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. That was Job's faith right there. That was his resolve in life. God, I may be struck down, but that's never going to alter how I feel about you and what I believe about you. That right there was the victory, the knockout punch against Satan, because what's Satan doing? Take all these things away and he's going to curse you. And Job says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Because Job saw his life as the Lord's. And if the Lord wanted to slay him, that's not going to change his attitude or change his perspective in just living for him or trusting him. Are we able to say that? Are we able to live in a way where you can say, Lord, even if you chose to strike me, it'd be easy to say, Lord, if you want to strike me down and take me out, that's fine. I'm still going to trust you. But we say, Lord, if you want to make me go through 20 years of suffering, easier to say, you can strike me down, Lord, I'm okay with that. Could we say, Lord, if it means going through 20 years of suffering, yet I will trust him. Are we able to say that? Because that's what being a living sacrifice looks like, as we've been going through that Sunday mornings in Romans 12. Being a living sacrifice where we're willing to say, Lord, my life is not mine, it's yours. And I'm giving it to you, I'm laying it down. Lord, so I understand that as I give my life to you, you can allow yourself to be glorified and praised through it in whatever situation you allow to come into my life. Are we able to live as living sacrifices? Are we able to lay our lives down and say, Lord, even if you were to strike me down or make me suffer for 20 years, if it's for your glory, Lord, may I be able to say, yet I will still trust you. Charles Spurgeon listed several reasons why he thought that slaying times were good times. First, such times show us that we are really his sons and daughters, because he only chastens those whom he loves. He chastens his children. Such times, slaying times, are when real faith is created. Such times are when God tests and affirms our faith. And many of you that have gone through suffering have acknowledged and seen how your faith has grown in those times. It's caused you to cling even greater to the Lord. Such times are when we can grow in faith. Such times allow the child of God to prove that they are not a mercenary professor of faith. Nevertheless, Job continues on in his persistence to make his case before the Lord. And it's not to demand God move in his life, but it's to prove that he himself is innocent. Job knows that God is his salvation. And he states there, he states in verse 16, that a hypocrite wouldn't be able to come before him as he is at this time. So he's aware of his innocence. Job's got nothing to hide, right? His friends are accusing him that he's hiding stuff. Job's going, I got nothing to hide. A hypocrite wouldn't be able to come before you as he is, as I am. And so from the rest of chapter 13, now to the end of chapter 14, Job speaks directly to God, and he's taking up that age-old question, why? God, why? He's looking for just some understanding. What have I done to deserve this? So he says in verse 20, only two things do not do to me, then I will not hide myself from you. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not the dread of you make me afraid. Remember earlier, Job had said, just, you know, let me go. Just leave me alone. And now he's saying, don't let your hand be withdrawn from me. He's again coming back to that faith, to that position of, Lord, I need you. Don't withdraw from me. But also, let not the dread of you make me afraid. Don't put me in a place where I am just in fear. Then he says in verse 22, then call and I will answer. Let me speak, then you respond to me. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. That's all Job is wondering. He's, Lord, what have I done? Show me. Reveal it to me. Verse 24, why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy? Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro, and will you pursue dry stubble? And you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch closely all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. Man decays like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten. So Job has felt like this, you know, leaf just kind of blowing in the wind, just to and fro, very vulnerable to these forces around him, or like this dry stubble that can just be picked up and blown away. He's feeling the Lord has continued to come against me. He's like, Lord, help me in this here. I just feel like I've been getting it from all sides. He's already seeing his days are numbered. And he's not sure why God seems to continue to press in against him. He's kind of thinking, Lord, I'm just like, you know, an easy target here. I've just been hit hard. Can you go and maybe focus on somebody else, or at least show me what I need to do, what I've done wrong here? Lord, reveal to me these things. And so the mood begins to shift here a little. No longer is Job confident against God, but rather he turns to this sort of melancholy lament about the futility of life and the certainty of death now. He says in chapter 14, and we'll end with this chapter. If you can bear with me for one more chapter, this is it. We'll get through this and then we'll be done. Man who is born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and fades away. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. And do you open your eyes on such a one and bring me to judgment with yourself? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? No one, since his days are determined. The number of his months is with you. You have appointed his limits so that he cannot pass. Look away from him that he may rest till like a hired man he finishes his day. So Job acknowledges that the days of man are brief and that they can be full of trouble. They can just be problematic. We're not guaranteed a smooth ride. We understand that. We're like a fading flower and a disappearing shadow. These things don't last for a long time. You'll see them one day, they'll be gone the next day. And yet, God is requiring an accounting of each day. And Job is understanding this here. You bring me to judgment with yourself. His days are determined. The number of his months is with you in verse 5 there. Job is just looking at his life and going, Lord, you're going to, you know, take me out of here soon. Life is short. Ultimately, Job is requesting God to just look away and to not trouble him anymore. Now, there's a reminder for us here to understand that, yes, our days are numbered, right? Our days are limited. Life is very short. Job is acknowledging that. He's recognizing that. And for us, we have to recognize, too, that, yeah, our life here is, I mean, what does James say? It's like a vapor. It's just here and gone before we know it. And it's a reminder for us that we need to live each day to its fullest, that we need to live each day to the glory of God and say, God, help me not to waste time. Time is so brief here. Help me not to waste time. Help me not to just, you know, squander my days away, but to live in a way where I'm bringing glory to you, where there's eternal value to the life that I'm living here. So Job goes on in verse 7, and he's just kind of coming to a place of just lacking hope in a sense here. He's just wondering, what's the point of all this? He says in verse 7, for there's hope for a tree if it's cut down, that it'll sprout again and that its tender shoots will not cease. Though its root may grow old in the earth and its stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and bring forth branches like a plant. But man dies and is laid away. Indeed, he breathes his last, and where is he? As water disappears from the sea and a river becomes parched and dries up, so man lies down and does not rise till the heavens are no more. They will not awake nor be roused from their sleep. Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait till my change comes. So Job compares human life to a tree now. He's saying if a tree gets cut down, well, it can still continue to grow here again. Water can come and tender shoots can come up again from it, and that will have life again to it. But human life is like water that evaporates or it soaks into the ground. It was there, and then it's gone. And you can't get it back again. Once a person dies, Job's conclusion is that there's just no hope. That's it. This, at least, was Job's view in light of the limited knowledge that he had. Now, Wiersbe says this, early believers like Job did not have the revelation of future life as we now have it in Christ. Passages in the Old Testament hint at future resurrection, but Job did not have any of these books to read and ponder like we discussed earlier. So if a man dies, shall he live again? Job asked this important question, but did not answer it. Later on, Job will make a great statement about future resurrection. Right? And he says, oh, my Redeemer, I will yet see him, right? With my eyes, I shall see God. He spoke of that hope of resurrection. But at this point, he's kind of vacillating between despair and hope. He's not quite having a full grasp of what happens after life here. But basically what Job is asking for is just to be hid in the grave and then just deal with things at a later time. God, just hide me in a grave. Just let me go to rest now and sleep, and that you would hide me and that you would just come and, you know, appoint me a set time and remember me. And then we'll just kind of reconvene and deal with things. Maybe I'll be over all my misery at that point. You know, this is sort of Job's heart and request and attitude right now. He says in verse 15, you shall call and I'll answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands. For now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag and you cover my iniquity. Verse 18, but as a mountain falls and crumbles away, and as a rock is moved from its place, as water wears away stones, and as torrents wash away the soil of the earth, so you destroy the hope of man. You prevail forever against him, and he passes on. You change his countenance and send him away. His sons come to honor, and he does not know it. They are brought low, and he does not perceive it. But his flesh will be in pain over it, and his soul will mourn over it. So Job knew there would come a time when his number would be called, when that would be, you know, the end for him. But Job at this point was just longing for death, and it was the only thing that he saw that could give him any kind of reprieve from pain, that this would be it. This would be the thing that I'm hoping for, that I could just bring a stop to this misery. He says, just as a mountain may fall, as water erodes things away, so God removes the hope of man. That's kind of what Job is thinking here. That's the only thing Job felt he could hope in was death. That was the only thing that could help him at this time, is what Job thought. Because God doesn't seem to be answering. God, it doesn't seem that there's any sense of this. So if this is the course, then death is the only thing I can hope in. Now for us, that's a true statement. The only thing we can hope in is death. But it's not our death. It's the death of Jesus Christ. And not only that, but we more so hope in the resurrection of Christ, in which he has secured life and life everlasting for us. Perhaps you're going through a trial presently, but we need to view things through the eyes of eternity. What caused Job, as we've gone through these chapters, to really begin to be kind of renewed in faith was this idea that things would end, that this is temporary. You know, that death was awaiting in a sense for us. It's not that we're awaiting death, but that we're awaiting resurrection. We're awaiting eternal life. For us, that's when we begin to view things through the eyes of eternity, that we have our faith sparked and we begin to be renewed in our joy and faith in the Lord. And we do. Unlike Job, who's wondering what hope he has, we do have hope in all things today because of who Jesus is and what he has secured for us. And Jesus himself said to his disciples that they were to take heart. He says in John 14, verse 1 and 4, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, then I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Where I go, you know, and the way you know. Praise the Lord that we know the way, and the way is through Jesus Christ, and he secured hope and life forever with us. And so, like he says to his disciples, let not your hearts be troubled. That can be the word for Job here. Job, don't be troubled, don't be down. There's hope. Your hope is not cut off. God does not destroy the hope of man. God gives the hope to all mankind. And it's through Jesus, his son, who secured life and the forgiveness of sin. Oh, and as we walk in that and abide in Jesus, may we continue to have that eternal perspective, that regardless of what trial and difficulty, regardless of what suffering we may have to encounter, we can recognize there's still hope. There's always hope in Jesus. Because this is not my fate. This is just temporary. There's better days coming. And it's all found in Jesus and the eternal life He has secured for us. So praise the Lord for that.